Hi, this is Alex Redfield. If you've listened to other episodes of our podcast from the Ground Up, you'll notice that most of the content we have on this feed is authors reading their submissions that are published in the magazine. One of the features we regularly have at From the Ground Up is the New England Policy Chronicle, where I try to highlight an interesting story from each of the six New England states that touches on questions or topics that intersect with our vision for a connected and well-designed landscape in New England. The stories we include in the Policy Chronicle are active news items, change frequently, and maybe out of date by the time that this episode gets published. We include them in this audio feed as a way to introduce you to the kind of discourse that's happening in legislatures around the region, and to invite you to share stories of where policy is being made, where it might be made, in a way that advances an integrated and protected landscape that supports all of our needs in the future. I'm going to read the bulletins that we include in the spring 2025 issue of the Policy Chronicle that introduce a new story from five of the six New England states. We don't dig deep into Vermont because Jamie Fidel of the Vermont Natural Resources Council has a really excellent piece talking about the state of forest conservation policy elsewhere in the issue. Please don't hesitate to reach out if you have a story idea or you'd like to talk about the policy implications of any of the themes that we discuss here or anywhere else in the magazine. Thanks. In 2023, the state of Connecticut outlined plans to achieve net zero carbon energy by 2040 and to become the central hub for clean energy production on the eastern seaboard. With the release of their offshore wind strategic roadmap, Connecticut policymakers identified the state's next steps for new infrastructure, capacity, and policy tools that would support rapid growth in the sector, and it resulted in a flurry of new contracts and new projects that launched over the past 2 years. However, just 14 months after the release of this roadmap, challenging market conditions and immediate withdrawal of federal support for offshore wind projects have combined to stall Connecticut's efforts to capture significant wind energy off its coast. In late December, Connecticut officials declined to select any bids from wind developers in the first round of a three-state solicitation collaborative between the southern New England states. This partnership between Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and Connecticut had been designed to secure more favorable terms for ratepayers and future offshore wind contracts for all three states, but December's announcement from Connecticut regulators may jeopardize the future of this collaboration before it even begins. Indeed, soon after Connecticut announced their decision to, quote, take a pass, end quote, on new wind contracts, developers announced that they were canceling plans for the Vineyard Wind 2 installation, a new development that was slated to provide 800 megawatts of wind energy to Massachusetts and 400 megawatts to Connecticut. In the same press release that announced the current pivot away from offshore wind, Governor Ned Lamont's administration announced three new ground mount solar contracts to increase clean energy available to the Connecticut grid. This clearly demonstrates the implications of a shift away from coastal energy development. If states are going to achieve their decarbonization goals without offshore wind, onshore infrastructure will need to pick up the slack, further challenging regulators to strike a nuanced balance between protecting the farms and forests of our region from conversion and ensuring solar development can proceed quickly enough to meet our collective energy needs. To Maine now. Maine's primary source of state funding for land protection and conservation efforts is the Land for Maine's Future, or LMF, program. LMF is on track to spend down the last of its allocated funding by the end of this fiscal year. With deep uncertainty about the continued availability of federal funding for conservation projects, advocates are hoping that Governor Janet Mills and allies in the Maine legislature will be able to secure both short and long-term funding to shore up the program. LMF has enjoyed broad public support, with voters consistently approving bond requests to advance land protection and approving a $40 million legislative budget allocation in 2021. These allocations have supported the acquisition and protection of more than 650,000 acres, including more than 333,000 acres of working farms and forests over its nearly 40 years of grant making. In Governor Mills' January budget proposal, new allocations for LMF and the majority of other climate-related recommendations put forward in the Maine Won't Wait planning process failed to make the cut, with a perceived drop in state revenue on the horizon. At the same time, legislators have introduced bills that would generate both immediate funding through a citizen-approved bond proposal and ongoing revenue from permitting and mitigation fees associated with energy transmission corridors and new mining projects. Though the proportion of federal dollars compared to state sources varies widely across the region, the impact of any significant shift in federal funding priorities would be felt regionally, underscoring the importance of robust state funding mechanisms to ensure the continuity of existing efforts. In Massachusetts, in a significant development for housing policy in the state, on January 8th, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court upheld the constitutionality of the MBTA Communities Act. This decision confirms the state's authority to mandate that the 177 municipalities served by the MBTA, or the Massachusetts Bay Transportation Authority, that the 177 municipalities establish zoning districts that permit multifamily housing construction by right. The MBTA Communities Act, passed in 2021, continues to roll out across the Commonwealth with a staggered implementation timeline and numerous legal challenges. Over the past 4 years, the core intent of the act has remained intact, serving as a legislative method to spur development of dense and accessible communities. In 2024, Massachusetts Attorney General Andrea Campbell sued the town of Milton, one of nearly 50 municipalities that remain non-compliant with the Communities Act standards, when residents there rejected updates to their zoning standards. The court's ruling in January affirmed the Attorney General's power to enforce compliance and upheld the state's ability to withhold funding from communities that fail to comply. Shortly after, the Massachusetts Executive Office of Housing and Livable Communities filed new rules for the program, offering municipalities that previously missed compliance deadlines an additional 6 months to align their bylaws with the Act's requirements. This extension aims to balance the urgency of increasing housing supply with the practical challenges municipalities face in amending local zoning laws. Though the requirements of the Communities Act directly affect only the communities on or adjacent to transit lines in Massachusetts, the structure and impact of the legislation will be monitored closely elsewhere in New England. Throughout the region, long-standing commitments to home rule, local zoning requirements, and community-level public sentiment often discourage the development of new housing projects despite the clear need. This Massachusetts law, as a representation of a strategic effort to promote equitable housing development in proximity to public transit, could serve as a model for lawmakers in other states seeking to promote more rapid development of new housing while also attempting to limit the impact of sprawl and unchecked development on natural and working lands. To New Hampshire. New Hampshire lawmakers are slated to review several bills aimed at addressing the state's housing crisis by reducing local control over zoning regulations. Proposed legislation includes HB 577, seeking to amend the definition of accessory dwelling units, HB 459, mandating a minimum lot size of half an acre for any development, and HB 631, permitting mixed use and residential development by right in areas currently zoned for commercial use. Proponents, such as Representative Joe Alexander, a Republican from Goffstown, argue that these measures are necessary to eliminate exclusionary practices often referred to as, quote, snob zoning, end quote, that hinder affordable housing development. Conversely, municipal officials are expressing concern that such state-level interventions could undermine municipal autonomy, disrupt established land use plans, and potentially increase the tax burden on residential property owners. This legislative push reflects a growing tension between the need for statewide housing solutions and the preservation of local governance. Another strategy under consideration in the New Hampshire legislature involves a proposed amendment to the state's current use property tax program. Since 1973, landowners with property enrolled in current use have benefited from reduced property tax assessments on natural and open lands to ensure that they remain as farms, forests, or open space available for public access and enjoyment. In exchange for that reduced property tax burden, landowners must pay a land use change tax if a property is withdrawn from the program and ultimately developed. Senate Bill 55 proposes waiving that land use change tax, equivalent to 10% of the parcel's fair market value, in any situation where the landowner is withdrawing their property to develop it into multifamily housing. This would theoretically reduce the cost of a new housing development. At a Commerce Committee hearing on January 27th, 2025, nearly 40 individuals and organizations submitted testimony in opposition to this amendment. noting that this tax serves as a key revenue source for local municipalities in their efforts to expand services or to protect other sensitive parcels, and that properties enrolled in current use play an outsized role in ensuring the viability of forest and farm-based businesses in rural parts of the state. Changes to current use could have a significant impact on New Hampshire's landscape, as 73% of the undeveloped, privately owned land in New Hampshire is enrolled in the program, the highest percentage in all of New England. And finally, a story from Rhode Island. In a moment where public and philanthropic dollars are coalescing around the ethical and ecological importance of returning land to its original indigenous stewards, the Trump administration is all but certain to end any federal support of land return initiatives. Though final decisions about the continuity of individual programs and agency mandates have yet to be made, the widespread commitment to ending federal spending on both climate change mitigation efforts and public efforts to support diversity, equity, and inclusion will clearly conflict with core elements of the key conservation programs built out in the previous administration. The America the Beautiful Challenge, for example, a cornerstone of the Biden-Harris conservation agenda, leveraged federal and philanthropic dollars to simultaneously expand indigenous ownership and landscape-scale conservation projects, contributing in no small part to the 420,000 acres of total land returned to the tribes in the past 20 years. As the fate of these federal investments hangs in the balance, other institutions must fill the gap to retain the momentum in supporting equitable, effective conservation through land return. In 2017, nearly 100 members and allies of the Pocasset Wampanoag tribe of the Pokanoket Nation set up an encampment on Patumtuk, known contemporarily as Mount Hope in Bristol, Rhode Island, and owned by Brown University since 1955. Notably, Patumtuk was the site of the execution of Poe Metacom after he led the regional revolt against colonizers known widely as King Philip's War. The occupation by indigenous leaders called for the Brown administrators to return the lands of cultural and ancestral significance that had been illegally seized nearly 350 years ago. After a month of negotiation with the university, the encampment disbanded when Brown agreed to transfer the land back to a preservation trust managed by the Pokanoket people. In late 2024, that commitment was upheld, and the university transferred 255 acres, marking a significant moment in indigenous land reclamation efforts in southern New England. As institutions and governments increasingly recognize the historical displacement of indigenous communities, this case may inspire other universities, municipalities, and private landowners to reevaluate their land holdings and to engage in discussions about restitution, stewardship agreements, or co-management strategies with tribes. Just 1 month after the Patumtuk parcel was returned, the Rhode Island Department of Environmental Management announced an open space grant in support of the Pocasset Pokanoket Land Trust's acquisition of a nearby 40-acre Atlantic white cedar swamp in Tiverton, further bolstering the land base under stewardship of the Pocasset Wampanoag people. Though the Brown transfer was perhaps spurred on more by public relations or moral considerations than environmental benefits, the shift in federal policy only reinforces the clarion call for building relationships, offering material support, and working together to build an equitable future for our neighbors and our shared spaces.